Hey, this is Sadler Vane, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you're listening to episode number 161 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. There are 161 episodes of Walking the Floor for you to catch up on while you're just sitting there locked in your house. I know what you're doing. You're doing what I'm doing. A whole lot of nothing. So get back there and listen to some classic interviews with the likes of Lucinda Williams and Dwight Yoakam and Steve Earle and Merle Haggard and Sturgill Simpson and all the rest of them, man. Just go back and look. You can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts, and there's a gazillion of them. Oh, what is going on in your world? Coronavirus, blobity, blobity, blah, blah, blah. Let's not talk too much of that because I'm sick of it and it's boring. So put down your Twitter machine and stop looking at it. It's just bad news, people. I will tell you some good news. I've been doing a lot of live streaming on my Instagram feed, and I've been corralling a bunch of people. Like, I've just been kind of hitting up like everybody I know. You know, who can I get to jump in on some of these things with me to entertain you folks? I've had Kendall Marvel, Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke, Jaren from Cadillac 3, and got a few more in the works, so stay tuned. I'm also going to be doing a bunch through some other people's social media, like Americana Fest. I'm doing one tomorrow through them, I think at 2 o'clock West Coast time? I don't know. Check my Instagram. Check whatever. Americana Fest. Going to do one through them. Going to do one, I think, through Martin Acoustic Guitars, maybe at the beginning of May, and Bose and Vox. And I'll tell you what, I did one, not a live stream thing, but Fender Guitars does like an artist check-in right now. And I posted one of those the other day, and I should have known better. Considering it's a guitar manufacturer, I should have put maybe something that was a little more like shreddy spaghetti, but I just did a very simple two-chord song called This Old World from my last record, and it, you know, seemed like lyrically appropriate, so that's why I chose that. But I should have done maybe something a little more dynamic, a little something more spectacular, because it seemed to open up the floodgates of comments. Like, my big takeaway from the comments was, it's a two-chord song, and I should just fuck right off. So there was that, was kind of the main one. And then the other one was, since when has Gerard Butler started working for Fender? Which I liked. I mean, he's a handsome man and a fine actor, and I'll take that all day long. And I think next time, if I do one of these things for Vox, I'll definitely try to put something a little flashier together for you guitar nerds out there. Okay, let's hear from the sponsors. Now, did you know that Zounds.com has 4 warehouses strategically located across the United States to get you your gear faster than anyone else, even during this coronavirus lockdown time? They're still working. And there's free shipping on every order, of course, as always, and there's no exceptions, no exclusions, even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10 speaker cabinets, giant synth boards, whatever. No shipping on every order at Zounds.com. You're stuck in your house, you need some gear, get on over there and let's do this, people. Come on. All right, let's get to today's interview. Okay, my guest this week is Sadler Vaden, South Carolina native, currently based in Nashville, ripping guitar player that used to play with Driving and Crying and has played with Jason Isbell's 400 unit for the last like 7 or 8 years and made a grip of records with him. But Sadler just put out a brand new solo record called Anybody Out There right before the coronavirus lockdown kicked in, and he of course had a bunch of tour dates that he had to postpone or reschedule or whatever, just like everybody else. And he was in fact my very first lockdown remote interview that I tried to do, and we did a whole nearly hour long great conversation that I realized after the fact I hadn't recorded, so it just went pew, off into the ether, never to be heard again. But he's such a nice guy, he agreed to do it all over again a week later, and it was great. And he answered all the questions totally enthusiastically, as though I'd never asked them before. And I think we even covered some different stuff in this one. So we didn't have the strongest Wi-Fi connection, so it's a little bit sonically glitchy here and there, but bear with us. It's, you know, this is the new lockdown reality that we're all living with. This is Sadler Vaden on Walking the Floor.
Doing it.
Can you hear
Sadler,
me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. But I got an important question to ask you, and that is, do you believe in the concept of deja vu?
Absolutely. Have you ever, I'm having it right now.
Right this moment, right?
Super weird.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry. I think I know what I did. I think I know, or I should say, I think I know what I didn't do.
First, oh, you know what you did. You know what you did.
Are you looking at your little video screen? Do you see a little cloud in the upper left-hand corner that says recording?
Yeah, that wasn't recording last time, was it?
I don't think it was. I think that I thought that I was recording it, and
we're not supposed to hit record. There's other people that are supposed to tell us when they're hitting record.
You know, my staff of millennials was not here.
Yeah.
And that is clearly the problem.
And you know, that's very offensive to me. Being a millennial of the elder, you know, that's offensive to me. They should know what they're doing. They should know better.
I have to tell you, I kind of hold you responsible because you should have such an innate sense of how all these things work that you should have told me we weren't recording. It's your fault. It's not my fault.
Hey, man. I don't tune the guitar. I just play it, all right?
Hey, man. That's right, bro. That's right. So we're a week deeper into coronavirus lockdown and all that. How is your state of mind? You look exactly the same as you did a week ago. So you don't appear to be unraveling.
I feel rugged. I feel ragged. I feel unraveled. I think I'm doing better with it now that we're another week into it. I'm kind of finding my groove. You know, how about you?
I'm okay. You know,
larger.
Yeah, I've just been doing, you know, between family life and we're all here and you know, it's, that's just sort of all day, every day, you know, it's we're all just living in each other's pockets, you know, just like everybody else.
Yeah.
It's radically different than normal life. It really is. Like,
yeah, I forgot I had a family. I was like, I have a family. Who are these people?
Right.
No, it's been good to, actually, you know, and I want things to return to normal in the sense of what, you know, you and I do and what so many of our peers and, you know, which is live music and recording music and all that. And, but I will say that I have been enjoying this break because the last 7 years, you know, touring with Jason and 400 units, just been like, go, go, go. And I know, you know what that's like. And so it is, you know, it's kind of nice to have a forced break somewhat that might not be imposed otherwise, you know, and I love my job and all that, but it's kind of like, man, I feel like I'm 17 and I don't have a job and I'm playing guitar and I'm kind of like, you know what I mean? But I'm like, but I have people to take care of, which is kind of weird, you know, it's a mind fuck. Can I say the F word on there?
100%.
It's just kind
swear
of
swear all you want.
It's weird because I feel like I'm young again since I'm playing guitar and listening to records and, you know, kind of just I'm doing chores.
Yes. Lots of chores.
I didn't know existed. I didn't know I had to do so many chores.
Well, you know, it's funny because we are sort of slowly introducing the concept of chores to our children, which I've realized through this break, where all of our like parental failures, you know, and a big one is like, I mean, this isn't even a chore. It's like, just can you just clean up after yourself? Because that's all I'm doing on this break.
Yeah,
it's cleaning up after you.
Yeah, yeah, and then you know, and you got to lead by example, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to
clean up. That's the hard part. Yourself. That's the really hard part. Like, what are you doing musically to sort of, you know, keep yourself busy?
Man, like,
are you live streaming and doing all that?
Yeah, I'm doing a little bit of that. I'm not doing like a ton of it just for my own profile because I'm starting to get, you know, fed some opportunities from Vox amps and like Fender and Gibson and Premier Guitar. And so they're, you know, I'm kind of following their lead on some of that stuff, like Instagram takeover stuff. And, but I'm also just, you know, I have been writing some stuff, which, just kind of, you know, happened naturally, which is to me the best way to write, like sort of when you get inspired and then clock in, you know, you get inspired, but then you got to chase it down and try to make it good. So I've been doing some of that. And then I've just been, once again, kind of rediscovering things that I was into when I was like 17 or whatever. Just like, you know, I've been listening to Blind Faith, you know, that one record, nice. Blind Faith. And it's just awesome, you know, and it's like, that's such a great Clapton too. And, you know, there's a lot of Clapton lovers. There's a lot of Clapton haters out there, but, that to me is like just one of his best things that he's ever done, which, cause he had Steve Winwood and Ginger Baker and the record's like six songs and they just put out that one record and I don't know. So I've been kind of like learning some of that stuff and listening to some older records, you know. That's what I've been doing to keep my brain healthy.
I heard a funny story, and I don't know if it's true, that Ginger Baker basically just like forced his way into that band. Like Clapton had broken up Cream and was like just wanted to go do something new, and that Ginger Baker was like, nope, I'm in your band.
that sounds very true, and I'm sure it is. And if it's not, we're just going to go with that because
totally.
we still need mythology to exist.
Absolutely.
We still need rock mythology.
For sure. It's strange right now, you know, in our industry. I mean, it's strange for everybody, no doubt, but it's as the infection rate increases and the death toll increases. I mean, it's just wild to see like John Prine and Ray Benson has from Asleep at the Wheel has coronavirus. I read yesterday.
Yeah. And we just lost Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne.
Right. Yeah. And all Joe Diffie, you know, like, is there's
Joe
like,
Diffie.
Yeah, it's just the list is growing. It's just, I mean, I don't even know where exactly I was going with that, but it's just strange times in our industry.
Yeah, it is strange. And I keep reminding myself that, you know, I'm very privileged to be able to self-isolate and social distance. And, you know, we can do this right here to keep our not get bored, which, you know, like boredom is a privilege, you know? And so
it's
we're privileged to be able to do this and to stay indoors and all that when, you know, a lot of people like their home isn't safe, you know, or they don't have that choice. Really, you know, but it is a wild time to be alive. You know, it is a wild time, not only to do music, but, you know, my wife's a nurse practitioner, thank God she doesn't have to see, you know, patients in person. She's got everything switched to telehealth right now, but,
really?
Yeah. I mean, those are, you know, grocery store workers and healthcare professionals and things like that. I mean, they're soldiers right now. I mean, they're out in the middle of it, you know.
They probably
people always think just the soldiers that are protecting us, you know, overseas or from an attack or something like that. Well, you know, we are being attacked. It's just you can't see it,
right?
You know, so it's I've been thinking a lot about all that. I mean, you don't have any choice right now because it's out there in front of you.
It's funny you talked about, you know, doing some songwriting in this downtime, and I've been doing some of that myself, and I feel like every song I'm writing, even if I'm not trying to write about the coronavirus, like those thoughts are creeping in. It's all, everything's sort of coming from a viewpoint of like isolation and being stuck and, you know, cut off from the world and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and you know, not to purposely segue into my record, but I mean, on my record, the title of the record is Anybody Out There, and that title track deals with isolation. So it's kind of weird that that just came out we're going through something like this, you know, and I hope people who are checking the record out.
You know. Are you suggesting that this whole thing is a gigantic marketing hoax for your record?
Huge. Yeah. It was an April Fool's marketing ploy.
I love it. I love it. You know? how is that? Like, I mean, what do you like? Your record just came out at the beginning of March. So I imagine you were just in that sort of early days of promoting it and setting it up and doing all the legwork that you have to do as an artist to let people know that your record's out there. So how has that sort of shifted? Are you doing a lot of that from home now? I mean, obviously we're doing that right now, but are you like is your label like hitting you up all day long to promote?
Well, I put the record out through 30 Tigers, which is ultimately I'm the label, which is off. I'm an awful label head. It hasn't been too different. I mean, it sucked because just like so many others, I had to cancel my shows like right in the front end of, you know, putting out a record. And it wasn't like I had some world tour plan, but I mean, I was going out and hitting up, you know, 8 or 9 different places kind of in the Southeast. And, you know, that would have helped kind of keep momentum up and things like that. I don't think that I've lost too much momentum though, because it seems like there are a little, you know, maybe there's less distractions in everyday life and people are sort of like digging in the music more and they're going, oh, well, this is new and Sadler just put this record out. So I feel like there's a good amount of people that are listening to the record and saying something about it on Instagram or Twitter. But it's, you know, it's hard to come up with a way to keep promoting it or ways to keep promoting it. So this is one way that I'm thankful for, and thanks for having me on. And then, you know, the IG, like the Instagram, you know, Premier Guitar had me take over their Instagram, yesterday and
oh, nice.
You know, play some, talk about the record. So that's really all I can do, you know? But it seems like people are still discovering it, and it's only been out a month, but, you know, it's still getting out there.
Yeah. So. It's, are you planning on, I feel like people within a couple of weeks or when this thing's all over, whenever this ends, people are never going to want to see this again. You know what I mean? Like people are never going to want to see somebody sitting in front of their laptop with a microphone and like an acoustic guitar going, here's me playing a real stripped down version of my song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or that becomes the new normal. Who knows? You know, it's one or the other.
Man. Yeah. I hope that it's only a couple of weeks out, but that's sadly, I think we're going to be dealing with this for a few months. But I think I tweeted the other day. I definitely tweeted the other day that it was Instagram 2020 is the world's largest open mic concert.
Totally.
Which it's not an attack. It's not a dig. It's just for funny. It's just a joke.
It's just an observation. It's an observation.
Funny observation. That's true.
It's very true.
You know, and I'm doing it myself, but I just was like, I got to find some humor. Everybody should find some humor.
Well, you know, it's funny with, I love that Instagram live stream thing. Like I've never done it until this. And so it's been like a bit of a learning curve to try to figure out like how to do it and how to make it interesting, because it is just me sitting there with an acoustic guitar. And
so I
brought in a couple friends the other day and we tried playing together, and that's like totally insane too, because there's like a latency, you know? So you're trying to play and you're like, but I think it's like, I kind of dug it. Cause I thought it was just like, it's just weird. You know, it's just like, it's just something to make it a little different and more
interesting for
people watching, you know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's the one person has to rush a little bit maybe drag a little.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, man, or it's like a delay pedal on the entire mix.
I don't know if you know my buddy Adam Kurtz, the pedal steel player out there in Nashville.
Yeah, I do. I know Adam.
He did some touring with me, so I had him play. He was playing steel along with me. We were playing a song. And I was like, when we got done, I'm like, Adam, your feel has really evolved since last time we played.
You're deep in the pocket, man. I mean, deep.
So buttery. Like, are you planning when we get through this, and we will get through this? That's very true.
Yeah.
Are you gonna reschedule your tour dates and kind of pick back where you left off?
I'm gonna try to, because, you know, as you know, 400 unit and Jason, we have a new record coming out in May, and so all of that has shifted. All those dates had to get moved, you know, rescheduled. So I'm thinking I will. You know, we honestly just went ahead and refunded people, because for me personally, it's hard to like look at a rescheduled date when everything is shifting on Jason's end. So, but yeah, I mean, I have to. I owe it to the people that wanted to come see me, and I owe it to the record. I worked really hard on the record. I'm proud of it. I think it's a good album. And so, you know, I need to. It's just when, I don't know. Hopefully there'll be a few tiny holes that I can get out there.
I'd like to believe that people will be hungry for some live music when on the other side of this thing, you know, so.
Hopefully. I think they will be. Yeah. Hopefully they're hungry and not scared to death.
Right. Well, it'll probably be a little bit of both, I'm guessing, you know, it'll probably be a little bit of both until things really, you know, that's what I wonder more than anything, is when are people going to be comfortable being in crowds again?
Mm-hmm.
That might take a minute. That's just something none of us are going to know until we're back at it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk about your new record. So you self-produced it. You do some production work for other artists as well, right?
Yeah. I've been easing into that. It's not something that I ever thought that I would do, but yes, I've been working with, you know, some smaller developmental bands and some younger, you know, artists, you know, singers and writers.
How do you maintain your sort of producer perspective when you're producing yourself?
That is that's challenging to do. And, you know, I did a lot of demos for this record. So that was my pre-production. You know, I would program some drums after I had the song written, play some guitar, lay some bass down. Just kind of a rough, well, not even a rough sketch, honestly. I mean, they were pretty good. They sounded pretty good. But then I would take those in the car, listen to them. That's usually my process with like writing and stuff. I do a demo of it, ride around with it. Because usually when I'm riding around with it, I'm sort of, you know, I have to concentrate on driving. So the music is entering my brain, and I'll notice when a melody or a lyric or something rubs me the wrong way, and I sort of can go back in and fix. So that's one way to self-produce. And then, you know, I got a bunch of guys in the room that I trusted, like Jimbo, the bass player for the 400 unit, played bass on the record. Fred Eltringham, who's an amazing rock drummer. He plays for Sheryl Crow. He was in the Gigolo Ants and played for Katie Lang and Wallflowers. Just a great drummer. And then my buddy, who's a producer named Paul Ebersole, who actually engineered the record. And so all of these people, you know, I'm buddies with, and I really just trust their opinion. And I trust that they will tell me if something's not working, a groove or a riff, something's rubbing or whatever, the tempo, feel. And I think that's important, to have people in the room that you trust and that you know will speak up, you know, and also they'll give you their real opinion on a song if you ask for it. So,
well, I think, you know, Paul Ebersole, you know, like you mentioned, is a producer in his own right. I mean, do those lines get blurred when you're making your record? Like, or does he, how does he manage to sort of take his producer hat off and not go down that road? Or does it matter? Is everybody just kind of like throwing ideas around?
He turned his hat around backwards. So he didn't take it off. He just turned it backwards.
Right.
Or to the side, you know.
Would he give you production advice facing the other way?
Yeah. Just sort of staring off into the blank wall, you know, talking to himself, but not really. I've been saying that he produced by default the song. But I needed that, you know, sure. And And I knew that was going to happen anyways, which I was totally okay with. And, you know, honestly, engineering, it is producing. And I don't think engineers get the credit they deserve sometimes.
Yeah.
Actually, all the time, really.
Yeah.
You know, so and to me, it's a form of producing. It's sort of like a piece of producing, you know.
Sure.
But it is nice that when Grammys are given out for records, engineer, you know, gets a grant, you know, I mean, they get recognized, but I think like sometimes it can be overlooked because there's so many variables when you're recording. It's the mic in front of the amp. It's the amp, it's the speaker. It's, you know, the player, the guitar, the so many things, the preamp,
totally,
the compression, and then it goes into the Pro Tools or tape machine, and then what happens after that? I mean, there's a lot of things going on in the chain.
To say nothing of like whoever mixed it, and then even the mastering person.
Yeah,
it's like there's
so many
all
things.
Super super important components of the end result.
Yes, yes, you need all those components to be good if you want a good result. But he's a great producer. He's an amazing engineer.
Right.
Like he learned from Jim Dickinson at Ardent Studios and John Fry and John Hampton, all great record producers and engineers. And, you know, Jeff Powell, all these Memphis guys. And so Paul really learned how you're supposed to learn engineering.
Right.
I mean, he can get drum sounds, and this is going to get gear talky here for a minute, but you know, he can put SM57s on drums and run them through just some API, you know, copycat preamps or something, and like, just, and you get a great drummer in there, and it sounds amazing. You know what I mean? It just sounds, it's like, if you know what you're doing, you know, you can get good sounds, and he learned the right way coming up.
Yeah. I mean, it really is like I've always felt that way. Like in this day and age where people can make, you know, you can make a record in GarageBand on your laptop with like absolutely no understanding of engineering at all and come up with something cool. You know what I mean? It's great. For my money, for my ear, nothing beats a great studio run by some people that really know how to do it, you know, how to like a great engineer, great producer, like that setup to me for the kind of records that I am mostly drawn to is just like nothing beats that in the world.
It's worth the money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you can get all those things there, it is worth the money. And you know, it's cool. It's cool that, you know, and at the end of the day, it's about your brain, you know, it's about what your brain is putting out there, you know. It's about songs and everything. It's like Phineas and Billie Eilish can do their record in their bedroom, which I find amazing. I mean, it's not amazing, but it's like, it's the brain, you know. I mean, they came up with that stuff, you know. The program and the way they did it, it's just a means. But the brain is, that's what it's all about.
How'd you wind up writing with Audley Freed? I know you guys wrote a song.
We wrote the title track. Anybody out there? That is, I'm just gonna go ahead and say, I think it's one of the. It's a good rock riff. It is a good, like blues pentatonic rock riff that
Indeed.
We got that no one else has gotten.
Right. No small feat. No small feat.
No, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So oddly, I saw Audley Freed play in the Black Crows when I was like 12 years old. At the House of Blues in North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and I was blown away. They were on the By Your Side tour, and they opened up with Remedy, and Audley's just, he just looks like such a rock star, and he was ripping solos and just holding the guitar over the crowd, like just so rock star. And I was, that moment stuck with me for a long time. And I got a chance to write with him when I was like 21. I was in Nashville and somebody hooked me up with him, and I was like, yeah, I want to write with him. He's one of my favorite guitar players. And we hit it off. The song was, I don't know, it was probably shit, but we hit it off. And years later, I got the gig playing with Driving and Crying, and I emailed Audley because I was moving to Nashville, and he called me and was like, man, I'm so pumped you're moving to Nashville. That's great. You got a great opportunity here with Driving and Crying. So he's really been like my friend tour. He's like my mentor, but now we're close. So I had pretty much all the songs for the record, but I wanted that one like t- token rock song. You know what I mean? Like, sure. I'm missing the big riff song.
Right.
I just wanted it. Yeah. I just wanted that for the record. And so we got together, and I'd been listening to So What, the album by Joe Walsh, a lot at that point. And I just loved like some of the just like, big riff songs that were just open. They had some jams and, you know, wasn't really about creating like a radio song.
Sure.
So I kind of wanted to do something like that. And
sometimes you just want a song that you can rip some guitar over.
Yeah. And exactly. And that's what that song was. And, but I always, and I've learned this from Kevin Kinney and Jason, is to always try and write a good song, no matter what, you know? And so that was, that was like the hard part.
Yeah.
That's the work. That's where the work comes in. 'Cause you're like, okay, well, we got this, like, what are we going to say? And, I commend Audley, man, because he wanted to bear down on the lyrics, you know? Because I think he's realized, being a guitarist, you know, for so long, like when you are writing a song, like you really should work on the words.
Yeah.
Best you can to try and get your point across. So he just brought up that it's hard to find somebody that when you're talking to, that they truly ask like how you're doing. A lot of times people just want to talk about themselves, and it's not really right or wrong, but it's like, you know, and so we decided to write about that. You know, and that's what anybody out there, that's how it came out. And I think we wrote a really great riff. You know, we tried to make it unique. And I'm really proud of that song. And then that, I was like, well, that's the name of the record, because it really sums up a lot of what these songs are about, you know, so.
And now it's the coronavirus anthem of the year, man.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, no. I know. You know what's funny about that is I wrote a talking about coronavirus anthems on Instagram. I put this song. It was like, wash your hands and keep it clean. You gotta wash your, just a blues, like, I don't know, just like a JJ Kill, like just having fun. Well, anyway, yeah. It got picked up by this thing called the Hand Wash Jukebox that is on Alexa. You can enable it on your Alexa, like for your kids. You could say like, Alexa, play Hand Wash Jukebox. I'm like one of the 15 songs that'll get rotated in there. So I wrote a coronavirus anthem. I wrote a hand wash.
So are you rushing back into the studio to cut like the proper version?
So talking about, I use my computer and I just cut a little version in my room.
Love
here,
it.
Just like a 25 second. You love know, they were like, it just has to be long enough to wash your hands. I'm like, all right.
Yeah,
cool.
Perfect. 25 seconds. That's like the magic number.
That's right.
When over the course of like your friendship and relationship and working with Audley Freed, as a guitar player, I have to ask you, has he ever opened up his bag of magical licks and tricks and shared some of his technique-y stuff with you?
Yeah, he definitely has. Like, he'll be the first to be like, oh man, I don't know any of that shit, man. I don't know any good shit.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's been because I have spent a lot of time playing guitar with him. It's been more of, he's given me opportunities. like right when I moved to town, he asked me to be in this thing called Sons of Zevon, where they go through the 70s. Like, each show is like 1971, and there's like 20 songs of that era that were popular. And so he asked me to be in that band. That was like such an education, because it wasn't just rock, it wasn't just this. It was like sort of everything. You know, you'd be playing Carole King, you'd be playing Stooges or whatever, you know, depending on the year. And then, you know, so we've spent a lot of time just like jamming together. So it's been less, you know, it hasn't been as much of a lesson, but yeah, he has definitely shared some inversions and some voicings and just, and I just picked up on little things, you know, that I've watched him, like his like just triplet runs that he does, you know, that like, it's kind of like, it's just like a nonstop thing. It's almost like you're falling down the stairs.
I always liken that to turning on a faucet when guitar players he turned on the faucet, man. I love it.
That's a great way of putting it. I call that, he's letting his dog eat.
Yeah.
He's letting the dog eat.
It's funny, you know, like with Audley in particular, you know, we live in this day and age of like everybody doing online lessons of one type or another. And I, to my knowledge, he never has. And that's a guy that I would love to see sit down. I'd love like an hour long Audley Freed deep dive on lead guitar play or any part of guitar playing, but you
he's
know.
Too humble. He's too humble, right? He ain't gonna do it.
Well, we got to start a petition.
We got to get him on a Patreon or whatever that thing is. Yeah. It's like, and once again, that rock and roll mythology, that, you know, mysticism.
That's you know right. What I mean? Well, it's kind of connected to that. I'm thinking about starting a new thing anytime I interview a guitar player, and that is to ask them, what is your guitar store lick? Like when you go into a guitar store, you walk in and you're looking around the guitars and you pick up that, you know, Les Paul on the wall or whatever and strum a couple chords. What's the thing that you always play? I feel like I have a couple things that I always revert to that I always play on
like
a guitar.
Popular things.
Right. You know what I mean? So like, what's yours?
Oh man. it's like, I mean, there's a few of them. One of them, Substitute by The Who.
Oh, you know, there you go. That's
like, you know, because I love like big, like chimey. So I'm such like a British rock power pop fan. And then there's just like the won't give, these are both Who things. It's like the won't get fooled again, just like gang, just gang, gang, you know, G, D, A.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I just want to see what that guitar is doing when I hit those chords.
Yes.
So it's less, I don't really bust in any solos. It's always kind of like a, you know, does this D chord sound the way I want it to?
Yeah.
Is it going to do that for me?
Oh, that's great. You know, a really good buddy of mine when I was a teenager worked in this guitar store where I grew up. And I remember he said something to me that stuck with me and informed what I do in a guitar store for like ever since. And because this guy worked there and he would have to, you know, listen to people come in all day long. And he was like, God damn, man, people come in and they try to play like the hardest, fastest thing they know on a guitar that they can't play.
Yeah.
You should just play some chords, man. You should just see what the, you know, what the, run the chords up the neck, just see if the intonation's good. See how, you know, and that always stuck with me. Not to say that I don't try to bust out my Ace Frehley licks eventually, but my first move is always, let's see what this thing does with some power.
Well, you're a pro, man. You're going to warm up. You know, I'm going to warm up a little bit. You know what I mean?
There you go.
My dad, man, rest in peace, man, Chuck Vaden, he always pointed out like, you know, he was born in 1952. So, I mean, he was like there for all the shit, the great era of rock and roll. He was there. He was like a 19-year-old, you know, but he would always point out when he was bringing me up and playing me his records and stuff. And he's like, the big boys, pal, man, they always warm up, you know, like The Who would open up with Summertime Blues or I Can't Explain or, you know what I mean? And you don't see that anymore, really.
Right.
You know what
I mean?
Right, like, it's like, it has to be this big presentation now, like right out the gate, instead of like, you know, Tom Petty would do it, but he was in that class. He was in that, you know, and they would kind of open up with like, you know, Listen to Her Heart or something. All right. Let's get the muscles going. Get that PA cranked up a little bit, you know, get my voice into it instead of like, you know, now like the big rock show is so like, it's such a spectacle.
Right.
When you get to a certain level, you know, everybody wants to come out like, you know, kick your ass kind of thing instead of like, well, let's just kind of get warmed up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's something to that.
Oh, for sure. I remember the singer for my old band pointed that out one time. I think he was talking about like Bad Religion or one of those bands that would like wait like two or three songs into the set to do the big push. Cause it's smart. Cause you want to let people like get back into the room. You know, they might be at the bar, they might be looking at the t-shirts or something. You want to like make some noise so that people can run back in.
Yeah,
and then you hit them over the head, you know?
Yeah, man. And the Stones, it's like all their songs are warm up songs.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's such a great thing to, if you want to look at how radically different like the world of like live music is, watch
the Stones at Altamont, or really watch any old Stones show. It's like the stage is this big. There's like literally like people just like sitting there watching them. It's so mellow. They're all kind of clustered together. Nobody's moving around. Maybe Mick got a little groove. I mean, you know what I mean? It's so different.
Yeah, that was or their Hyde Park thing.
Yeah, you right. Know? Yeah, yeah.
After Brian Jones died and Mick Taylor, and you're like, God, that stage, they're like playing on like cardboard or something.
Right.
Like,
what?
You know, it's like a foot off the ground, and there's like chicks like with doves, you know, just hanging
around.
Like, what is going on out there?
You just mentioned your dad. Let's talk about that a little bit. It's like, where do you, was your dad your sort of primary influence growing up? Like, do you think, was that where you got the music bug?
Yes, definitely. He was like such a big music fan, man. I mean, you know, and like I mentioned, like when he came up, he was like, yeah, he loved The Who and J.J. Cale and like Linda Ronstadt and Frank Zappa and all this. I mean, he had really great tastes in like rock and roll music. Yeah, man, I think he was living vicariously through me when I took up guitar and actually like became like, you know, started to show that I was like, I could play the guitar, you know.
Like, when was that? Like, how old were you when you picked it up?
I was 10 years old when I picked it up. And that was after I saw Neil Young and the Crazy Horse at a festival called Farm Aid 96. And when we got back, my dad busted out this Yamaha red label. It's called an FG-180 Yamaha acoustic guitar out of the closet. And I was like, where the hell did that come from? I didn't even know we had a guitar.
Where have you been hiding that?
Yeah, I was like, what the hell? And he was all jacked up from the concert. So he was like inspired and he played a little bit, knew some chords, some cowboy chords and things. He could figure things out though pretty good by ear. I was very impressed. Like he figured out like, is this going to be, are we going to use the video for this, Chris, or is this going to be audio?
This is like my first foray into Zoom. So it's nice that it has this. I was thinking, yeah, I might chop a little, some of these up and put them on my Instagram or something.
Yeah, well, he one day figured out this.
Yeah.
Here comes, like, he just figured it out by ear.
Nice.
Like, that's kind of amazing, Dad. You know? It's like, wow. Like, no guitar tab or anything. And
right.
He sat with something long enough he could figure it out. So that's just about him. As a musician, he wasn't really a musician. He just kind of was, he was slightly musical anyway.
And for people watching or listening, that was before you could go on YouTube and have everything on earth explained to you.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. You had to sit there with your ears and your brain and a record player, whatever you had to play it over and over. But yeah, he absolutely was my biggest influence. I mean, he turned me on all the records. He was very encouraging. You know, he would point out so many things just about a song or the way somebody played. You know, he wasn't a guitar teacher, you know.
Right.
But he taught me a big lesson, which is to, when you get frustrated, put it down and come back to it. And
right.
The first ever solo I learned how to play was You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC.
Yeah.
And it was back of a Guitar World magazine, you know, and I learned how to read the tab from a friend down the street. I couldn't get it, you know. I was so close to having it, which is a very useful solo for a guitar player if you're learning or whatever. I mean, that is, you know, major, minor, it's all great stuff. Anyways, I put it down for about 2 hours. I went and shot some hoops, you know, came back in, picked up thing and just nailed it. And that's always been the case for me when I'm learning something that I don't know how to do and I get frustrated, I'll come back to it, you know, put it down.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I find like sometimes if I get frustrated and I put it down, you sort of can't turn it off in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You almost like you're woodshedding it in your head. And then when you do come back to it, it's like somehow that translates to this. you know?
Yeah, it's like you're practicing guitar in your head without having the guitar.
Right, right.
You know, you totally. Just see it, you know, you visualize it. And then like that, when you step back into the world, you know, it's almost like you've been practicing without it in your hands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, when did you go from being, you know, you're 10 years old and you're just starting to play? When did you start playing in bands?
Playing in bands, I think I was 15.
Okay.
You know, and I feel like that's kind of like the age where you you enter a band.
Oh yeah, that's when it was for me. My ninth grade talent show. That was the
yeah, start. Yeah, and you know, I played. Dude, it's so funny. I think you'll appreciate this. I played in a few like punk bands. There was a band called The Heathens that was in Somerville, South Carolina, which is where I went to high school. But I was like super into the Beatles and Fish at the time.
That was probably frowned on by your punk rock bandmates, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. But I was like good as shit on the guitar. Like right. They couldn't deny being in their band. Okay. Like,
you know what's so funny, dude? That was my entry into punk rock bands, was exactly what you're talking about, was I could play a little bit, but I was like a long-haired Hesher kid. But in the 80s, like when I was a kid, if you look at a lot of like punk rock band pictures, there was always like one Hesher kid in there, and it was probably usually the guitar player.
Yeah, because like they needed you to be like somewhat good. Yeah. You know, it's like,
were they like, Sadler, don't wear your Fish shirt to the gig, bro. Come on.
Oh, dude. Yeah. I mean, I had like the homemade hemp necklace. I mean, because this is like, you know, this is like coastal, you know, South Carolina shit, man. Yeah, this is like the Beatles yellow submarine shirt and, you know,
of course.
Jeans and Birkenstock.
So when did you go from that? I know you did, you know, you had a band that you opened for Driving and Crying and some different people, but when did you join Driving and Crying? Like, how old are you and how did that all come together?
So yeah, I was 25 when I joined Driving and Crying, and that was in 2011. And that was the same year, like I kind of split up with my band and, you know, it was quarter life crisis, I guess they call it. I was like, I've had this band for 7 years. I'm not where I want to be. And so Driving and Crying had just split ways with their guitar player, and I was a free agent, and they found that out, and they were kind of like, let me tell you this. Tim, the bass player for Driving and Crying, moved to Charleston, found out I split it with my band, and they had parted ways with their guitar player. He called me one day because he wanted me to give him a ride to Asheville, North Carolina for a gig. And he was like, you know, bring your guitar and amp and all that stuff, sit in with us and all that. And I was like, of course. I didn't know Tim that well, but I was like, bass player, one of my favorite bands, I'll give you a ride to your gig. And that night I ended up playing almost the entire set with Driving and Crying.
Really?
After the show. Yeah. After the show, Kevin, I'll never forget it. He was sitting in the driver's seat of the van talking to me, and he's like, well, what are you doing the next couple of days? And I was like, I'm just going to go back to Charleston and hang out with my girlfriend. And, you know, I don't know. And he's like, well, we got some shows. We're going up to New York and Connecticut. If you want to come, man, I'll give you $100 a day, you know? And I was like, that's real money to me at the time. And I was like, yeah, I was like, one thing though, I need to go to Walmart and get some underwear and socks.
I'm going to need an advance on that $100.
Yeah. Cause I didn't have it. All I had was the clothes I was wearing. Cause I was just going up and back, you know?
I mean, that's amazing. That speaks volumes about your guitar playing, your musicianship. I mean, you said you were a big fan of the band, but like to be able to just sit in with a band, like they're not just like jamming, like they've got songs, you know, with parts.
Yeah, this song driven.
You know
what
I mean? Yeah, like that's insane.
Well, you know where that came from was playing. So man, when I was 18, you know, like my dad died when I was 18, and he was very young. He was 52 years old. My mom died on my 21st birthday, and she was 52 as well, 3 years later. And, but when I was 18 is when my dad passed away, but he was at, before he died, he was trying to do everything he could to, you know, figure out how to get something going for me as a musician. He saw my talent as a guitarist, and he was trying to do anything he could to get me out there. So anyways, these local guys in Charleston that had cover bands had heard about me, invited me to come sit in with them, like in a bar. They had to sneak me through the back door because it was like, you know, over 21. It was a bar, you know?
Yeah.
Then, man, I started working for these bands. I started working for these cover bands. Like I was like the monkey, you know, just like,
right.
Go monkey, go, you know, right. Like when it was time, like play a solo or whatever. But I learned a lot of music that I didn't want to learn, you know, because at the time I was like, man, I'm not into that. Like Dave Matthews, whatever. I mean, I right. love it now, but at the time I was very much against it. But I learned a lot of different, I had to learn a lot of different styles, and I had to like play stuff I didn't know.
Yeah.
On the spot. That's where that came from. That's where right. that quote came from for me. When I joined Driving and Crying, I was like, well, this is nothing I'm not used to.
Yeah, it's funny. I always say like that's the mark of a really good player is not how well you play the song, but how well you recover from screwing up.
Yeah.
When you miss that chord, but you slide into the right one, you know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And in your mind, when you mess up, it's like everyone sees it and notices
right,
it.
Right.
But that's not the truth.
Ever. It's just, yeah. Nobody knows or cares. They just want to have a good time.
Man, you know how many times I've seen the Stones and Keith Richards is literally playing a half step off. He's in the entire. I don't care.
Right. I don't care. Yeah.
You know, it's like it's not about that.
What kind of things did you learn playing with veteran art, like a veteran band like that? You had to be like, you know, they had to all be like, you know, close to twice your age by the time you joined.
Yeah. Well, I learned a lot about like set lists, like flow, and Driving and Crying wouldn't even write a set list. You know, I've learned about, I feel like I learned how to like let my mind be free on stage, you know, and I've always said like Driving and Crying was like my college years that prepared me for the real world, which was like joining Jason's band and
right.
step up and playing in front of a lot of people and all that, you know.
How did you join Jason's band? How did that come about? How did that happen?
So we had a little bit of a relationship with the band I had called Leslie, that was the group I was in before Driving and Crying, but we used to open for Driving and Crying and Jason. And so Jason, I was on his radar as, you know, a young Southern guitar singer with a band. And then I joined Driving and Crying. I think he, you know, saw that and heard about me being in their band. He came to check me out one night when we were in Muscle Shoals playing. And then he got cleaned up. He made Southeastern and, you know, he wasn't playing with another guitarist at the time. So he was playing all this acoustic guitar on that record, which was life changing for him and for us in the band too. But according to Amanda, his wife, he was like, I need another guitar player for the record. And she was like, why don't you call Sadler? He's a nice guy. He's a good guitar player. And so he called me. Actually, his manager, Tracy Thomas, called me and said, hey, I heard you wanted to join our band. And I was like, which band? she's like, 400 unit. I was like, I know. I just was kidding. But, I was like, well, I mean, I'm in Driving and Crying right now, you know? And so it was an easy decision to make professionally, but it was a hard decision to make personally.
Yeah, sure. You
know? But Kevin, Kenny, he's a singer of Driving and Crying. I mean, he was nothing but supportive and just, you know, I'm a lot younger than these guys. And I wanted to see the pasta stick against the wall. You know what I mean? Like they had seen that. They had been through that in their life already. And I kind of was wanting that for myself. So I knew that
It
wasn't promised, but nothing's guaranteed in the music biz or in life. But he was going like this, and he wasn't there yet, but I could feel that it was a good move to make. And honestly, I just enjoyed playing with him.
And what's that been like? I mean, how long have you been in the 400 unit now?
I've been there 7 years next month.
And you guys have made a couple albums in that time, right? Two or three records?
Yeah, we've made, let's see. We just, the fourth one that I've made with them is about to come out.
Okay. And so what's he like as a band leader, and what would you say you've sort of taken away from being in that band, you know, on a songwriting front, or just, you know, just as a band leader?
Well, it's cool because, you know, his name is on the marquee and all that, and we're a backing band, but he's very much a just band guy. You know what I mean? He doesn't treat us like we're below him or anything like that. You know, we're his peers and we're his friends. And so that's really cool. You know, that's a cool thing about being in this band. I've learned a lot from him. I mean, I've learned a lot from him as a guitarist. He's a wonderful guitarist.
Absolutely.
I think he's probably maybe learned a few things from me too. We feed off each other really well. You know, I just, it's weird. It's like, it's all, you know, you make music and you play in bands and you're kind of like, man, why isn't anyone coming to see us, or, you know, whatever it is. Like if you weren't lucky enough to, you know, be successful in music. But it's like, I've seen it with my own eyes. It's like what I've learned from him is it's just songwriting, you know, 'cause you just see it with people. It's like, it's about connecting with them. It's not like writing something that you think is going to be what people connect with or whatever. It's just like you writing the best song you can write and, you know, making it meaningful and coming from your heart. I think that's like all you can do. And, you know, I know Dave's done that too. I mean, he's written songs that people just connect with. You've seen it with your own eyes, you know? So that's something I learned a lot from him. It's just like bearing down on your songs, you know,
trying to
editing, you know, just like, and also writing like your perception. Perception's important, you know. He's talked about an exercise he does where he like just writes, like he looks in the room around him and writes things down that are around him.
Right.
I think if you do that, then chances are you're kind of, you know, people might connect with it easier when you're talking about how you view the world.
That is like one of the great mysteries of songwriting. You know, when you, it always seems like the stuff that's the most personal, and maybe you would think people wouldn't get, you know, it's like something just straight out of your life. And that's the stuff that people wind up connecting to the most, you know,
yeah.
it's like when you're the most specific to your own experience.
Yeah.
It's like counterintuitive.
Yeah, it's like, I believe Tom Petty when he said, "You got lucky, babe." Like, I believe him, knowing what we know now about his relationship at the time.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that was real. I think he meant that.
He meant that, for sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, one example, I actually have a song on my record called Good Man, and that is a real example of a conversation that Jason and I had one night, and we were talking about songwriting, and I was asking him questions and stuff, and he was cool enough to share some of those thoughts with me, especially about like perception. And that song, Good Man, starts with the first verses, looking at my guitar, and I want the song to, you know, basically come out, you know? And then I say, I'm aware that from day one, I've had an easy out, you know, I'm a middle-class white male, you know what I mean? And then it just goes right into, not everyone feels the same, but still I want to be the change. In the mirror, I can see who I want to be. I want to be a good man, you know? So like it went literally from me writing about in my room, like I'm just looking at my guitar, like, oh, I want that fucking song to come out of that thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's what that song turned into. It turned into an anthem about being a good man.
Yeah.
That's an example of, you know, conversations we've had about songwriting.
What kind of like editing do you do with your songs? Because that's one of the things that I have enjoyed so much about my last couple records with Dave Cobb is I feel like one of his great strengths as a producer, and I know you've obviously worked with him a bunch too, is his ability to edit your, help you edit your songs and sort of point out what the fluff. Now you don't need that. Get rid of that. Get rid of half that chorus. You know, you don't need that third verse. You know, you don't, you know, that's, that, it's funny. Like I feel like at least in my own songwriting, it's always too much, you know, it needs to be pared back. It needs to be shaved down, you know?
Yeah. I've gotten better at that because I've worked with Dave and worked with Paul Ebersold and I've worked with Jay Joyce and I'm working with a bunch of producers. And I feel like that's all they're doing. They're literally just like ripping that, you know, just getting stuff that's superfluous out of there. Like, you know, and then some songs want, like, you know, some songs are served better with it if they have some musical moments that are just musical.
Yeah.
Just depends, you know. I think it's all about what the type of song is, the lyrical content of the song, and following your gut. You know, I think Dave's great at just making decisions and then sticking to them.
Yeah, big time.
For better
big
or time. Worse, you know. Yeah. Like, and I mean that. I mean, I think you would agree with that. Like, you know, it's just about that's a big part of producing, I believe, is like making decisions and kind of standing by them.
Right. Yeah. Hey man, thank you so much for doing this today. I have to say you did a wonderful job of answering some of the same questions I asked you a week ago with equal enthusiasm. No one will ever know.
Man, did we do this a week ago? I don't remember at all.
It wasn't this good. And last week's was so super core. That was just for us. That was a really special limited edition.
Yeah, I didn't like that one. I'm glad we had a redo. I personally was not a fan of that.
Yeah, that's. I never am. All right, that was Sadler Vaden on Walking the Floor. As always, get on over to walkingthefloor.com, where I'm going to put up a bunch of links to all sorts of stuff that we talked about in this interview here today, and you can find him online and support your local scene, baby. I've been doing a lot of interviews remotely since the lockdown began. There's many, many more to come. I interviewed Midland the other day. I interviewed Wild Flowers. I still have my Steve Gorham interview from before the lockdown even kicked in. Steve Gorham of Black Crowes fame, who recently wrote his autobiography, which you should definitely read because it's amazing. So all that's coming in the coming weeks and months. So sit tight, wash your hands, be safe, don't do anything stupid, stay at home, and we'll all get through this together separately. All right, that's it for this week, kids. Adios, amigos!